Hello, and welcome to Pinecone Podcast, where we have conversations about issues that are important to you, like faith and family, religion and relationships, Christianity and the church, and a whole lot more. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy Art, Wes, and Lacey as they have a conversation on Evergreen's Pinecone Podcast. Okay, welcome to our show. Today we're going to be talking about redemption for a bitter life. It is the recent sermon series from our pastor, Wes White, at Evergreen Church. Wes is here with us today. How are you doing, Wes?
Doing great.
Great. Good to hear you and see you. We also have Lacey Shingleton on here. Lacey has a brand new mic and a brand new setup. So let's see how it works. Lacey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Art?
I'm great. You don't have the same sense of humor Wes did. He would probably just not have said anything and made me think it didn't work.
True story.
I did not think of that, but that would have been brilliant.
Wes says, that sounds like me.
Yeah, it does sound like him, doesn't it?
Yes.
So redemption for a bitter life. We're talking about the book of Ruth, and we're talking about I'll let Wes have the thunder here. Whose life are we talking about? It's not Ruth.
Yeah, that's right. I have actually come to think of the book of Ruth as being about Naomi, not primarily about Ruth. Ruth is one character who is important, but the drama of the story is built around Naomi. Because she's the one who gets in this difficult position and then is brought out of it. So that was the focus of my, that's kind of been, give me the structure for my sermons.
Right.
And you thought of this book.
Right. And you structured it around the people, the characters.
That's right.
Do you want to go through those characters real quick before we really get into it? Or do you want to do it as we go? Or?
No, I want you to decide.
Okay, well, I'm deciding. So, Lacey, how do you want to do this?
I think we should name the characters.
So we've name got, the characters.
We start off with Naomi.
Okay, Naomi.
We moved along to Ruth.
Who is Ruth in this?
So, Ruth is a Moabite woman who is the daughter-in-law of Naomi. And she stuck with her through some pretty difficult times. And that is the first glimpse of hope that we have in this story. And then we've got Boaz, who is the kinsman redeemer.
Can I stop?
Yeah.
Because I think, like, in order to set the scene for the hope that is brought, you got to see the lack of hope. So that,
yeah, you know, I was just naming characters.
Maybe. Oh, I know. And you did a great job. So the basis of the, what creates the drama is the lack of hope that Naomi has in that her husband dies. Then she still has these two sons who are married, but both of her sons die. And so she has to return to her land without her support of father or have husband and sons. And so how is she going to make it through is really the question of the book. And that, you said, Ruth became the first part of that answer as a companion, then Boaz, and you were giving a good explanation of Boaz. So continue if you would.
Boaz is the kinsman redeemer and sort of the second glimpse of hope that we get in this story. And I'm sure we're going to go into that further. And then Obed is our fourth
character. So Naomi went to Moab, right? And she had her husband Elimelech,
yes,
and two sons, and obviously two daughters-in-law.
Well, when she went there, she didn't have the daughters-in-law.
No, but when she got to Moab, she had this as her family.
Mm-hmm.
And then as Wes said, Elimelech died.
while she was there. So she still had the sons and the daughters-in-law. So that was a good thing. That was good that she had them. And Wes, I think that actually was just reading your post today, rereading it, I should say. And I like what you pointed out about the sons and why the sons continued to give her hope, even though she lost her husband. And I think we should point that out. Do you want to flesh that out just a little bit?
How did you receive that? I'd be interested to hear what your broader thought is on that.
Well, because of what you said there, that she still had the sons, so she saw her husband in the sons.
Right.
Which continued to give her, I guess hope, or a positive hope for her present and her future, because she still had the comfort, I guess, mm-hmm. of having her sons there. And that was a part of her and a part of her husband and a part of what her and her husband had together.
Right. And so yeah, there's first of all the reflection of Elimelech in the face of her sons. So that's in a way he's still with her through their sons. But then also children in and of themselves represent hope. So that's why I say children represent the future. And a hope is an expectation of good things. And so the children represent the hope for the future. But when the children are lost, that's why it's so devastating, is because then your hope for the future is cut off.
Right. So she had this hope. She had the sons. And then what happens in the story? The sons die. Mm-hmm. So now she's left without that. So she decides to go back to Bethlehem, right?
That's
back
right.
Back to Israel, back to Bethlehem. And she tells the two daughters-in-law, Ruth, and the other one's name was Orpah?
Orpah.
Right? Not to return with her, to stay, to find husbands there, and to find families there in Moab. And Orpah does that. But Ruth continues with her. Lacey, you got any thoughts on that particular part of the story, that Ruth continued with her?
First, I kind of want to backtrack a little bit, because even more than being a hope for the future, children specifically in that culture would have also... specifically sons would have meant her inheritance, her legacy, her
the name continuing.
So. Yeah, the name continuing, but also they would have been the ones to provide for her, which
right.
when they're gone, you don't even know, you know, she wasn't even sure how she would be provided for at that point. So I think that's an important, you know, her entire livelihood was lost with her husband and sons. And so I think that's a really important thing to point out. And the reason that she renamed herself Mara, from Naomi to Mara, which means bitter. And if anyone has a right to be bitter, it's at that point, I think that there's you could make a good case for Naomi. With Orpah leaving and Ruth continuing on with Naomi, it's such a beautiful picture of the commitment that Ruth made to her husband and to her husband's family being carried out. She was going to a place where she didn't know anyone, and she would probably be an outcast because she was not from their culture, but she continued that commitment anyway, and saying some of the most poignant lines. I think a lot of people have probably had this read at their wedding. I know we did, about, you know, where you go, I will go; where you stay, I will stay. Your God, she's making a declaration about who her God is going to be, which is a huge thing. For her to do. your God will be my God, your people will be my people. And just the commitment that Ruth is making to Naomi at that point is just a beautiful picture of just, I think, hope, the hope that Naomi was going to have fulfilled, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. But as far as Naomi's perspective, that almost might have added to her bitterness, or her bitter, you know, her downtroddenness or whatever, because now she has this responsibility for Ruth, that Ruth is going with her. And that's a good thing. And I think, you know, and obviously we know the end of the story, and we're getting to that. It ended up a good thing. But now she also has this daughter-in-law who's going back with her, and she has no way to provide for herself nor for the daughter-in-law. You know, she can't provide a husband or a family for the daughter-in-law. So it just adds to her burden, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'd have to think about that.
I think to some extent it could, but the fact that she, you know, knew her culture way better than we do right now, in her mind, she may have been considering like, okay, well, this will give us an opportunity for kinsmen redeemers. She knew who those people were going back. Wes, do you have more of like a, can you flesh out a little bit more that cultural kinsman redeemer, how often that was like used during that time? Or?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's not, we don't really have a ton of examples of it in the Bible, which makes the Ruth story particularly poignant in that regard. So, I mean, in terms of what it means is just, it's not dissimilar from something you might see today, in that if a person dies and they don't have children, that a close relative might take responsibility for those things. But in those days, it also included a lot more than ours would, particularly in that they would seek justice in the case, like if their relative was murdered, that they would carry out justice, which could mean even like a retributive killing. And those were regulated by the Lord as he took that custom in. But then it also could mean caring for their property, that they had a right to purchase their property, even if someone else owned it, that person would have to sell. If a relative wanted to buy the sold property of one of their relatives and redeem it. But then you also have the idea of producing an heir for a close relative. And you see that in the book of Genesis, that a child, this was a common Near Eastern tradition, not just biblical, that you would produce an heir for a sibling who had died. And so levirate, I think, is that the term, marriage. And so, and even Jesus is asked about that by the Sadducees, if you remember, when they say, you know, the brother marries the spouse, then he dies, then the next brother, then the next brother, next brother. And they say, well, whose spouse will she be in heaven or in the resurrection? And he said, you just don't get it. So what the resurrection is all about. So it's still in Jesus' day that was continuing. And we have still something like that in our society, that you would have relatives helping one another out or taking responsibility or caring for the children, like a child would be given to a grandparent or something like that. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah.
Were you going to go somewhere with that, Lacey, or?
No, I imagine that she had that in mind, like going back even just for herself, like finding that kinsman redeemer. And hopefully, you know, carrying out the name of her husband and the legacy of her family. And so, I don't know, maybe with Ruth coming along, a plan started forming in her mind.
Sure.
And I think that's possible. I don't think that's what she was doing, though. I don't think she had that hope when she was going back.
Yeah. It might have been. It's possible, though, that it might have been there in the back of her mind, because she does seem to direct Ruth in some ways as she's going through this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she's the one who tells him how to ask him to marry her by sleeping at his feet.
But it definitely doesn't take away from her bitterness, is what I think you're getting at, Art.
Right. So how do we get, okay, the sleeping at his feet, how do we really fast hit the fast forward button?
Oh, we did.
So we have Ruth and Naomi back, you know, on their way back to Bethlehem. And now Boaz enters the picture. So Ruth begins to glean from Boaz's field. What does that mean? She was working in the field. How did she end up doing that? That's how she provided food for her and Naomi. How did she?
Well, this ancient, it's another ancient tradition where the crops wouldn't be fully harvested. You wouldn't go back and get every last scrap, but you wouldn't shake the olive tree twice. You'd leave the remainder for the poor. And that was God's provision for the people, for the poor, and that so that they could work and provide for themselves. And I think it seems like a pretty good idea.
I do too.
It's a great idea. How did she end up in Boaz's field doing that? Was it luck?
I think it's the providence of God, God's ruling, but in the story, there's no clear reason why she ends up there.
Right.
I want to go through something back to something that Lacey said. What I heard you say, and we can rewind the tape if we need to prove it. Just kidding.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding. No, you said one of the reasons why children was devastating is because they were her provision. And so I had a sense that you were saying that was the big reason why it was so devastating. But I had a question about that, because today, children aren't the livelihood or the care of parents in their old age in the same way they were at that time, particularly in agrarian society. But yet still the loss of children is the most grievous for people. And that's why I say, I wonder if there's more of a spiritual element to that than just the concern over provision, that I think that the spiritual element might be bigger. And by spiritual element, I mean that there is a sense that this is your future. This is you carrying on. And now that's cut off. So the future seems to be dark. And I know it's probably not like stated in those lofty ways, but that's the sense of it. There's something behind that. And you may have some insight into that, but I just wondered what you thought of that.
Well, I wasn't really saying that it was the biggest reason that she was upset. It was just more saying it is one reason she would have had to be upset that we wouldn't necessarily have today. Because women were cared for by their male relatives in that time period in a way that doesn't happen today. Sure. So that's kind of why I was pointing that out. I think especially for women, there is a spiritual element to the loss of a child, but also there's a loss of your identity almost. I have sure. somehow failed this child or somehow failed in some way that, or just a loss of like, I'm a mom is one of the people that, you know, that's one of my roles, and that there's a loss of your own identity in the loss of your child.
I would call that spiritual as well. Mm-hmm. What I'm contrasting spiritual with is like mere physical care, is so that mere physical provision. But yeah, even what you're saying there indicates that the significance of children goes far beyond just the mere fact that they are there or they give you something in the moment. They're the basis. They form a big part of how we see reality.
Right.
I'm genuinely thinking through this disagreeing with you, but so how then would you integrate what you just said into the fact that for fathers as well, the loss of a child can be one of the most devastating things? Because it's understandable in regard to a mother that, you know, who actually births the child and feeds that child, that it creates such a spiritual significance, but for fathers as well. So, I mean, I think it's worth reflecting on, but I'd love to hear your thought if you have one.
Well, I think one of the major roles that dads kind of take on is provider and protector. And there is a significant loss of identity there as well. If you, you know, the fact that you could not protect your child from whatever it was, you know, whether it be miscarriage, or, you know, any sort of loss, it's a reality check that you are fallible, I guess. You are not, it's a reminder that we don't have control as well. I'm also thinking through this, so I don't even know if I'm picking the right words, but I'm thinking a lot of our identity is wrapped up in our kids. And whenever we lose one of them, I feel like it is a loss of one of those roles, or a failure of one of those roles.
And so I think that, so the thing that I'm seeing here is that, you know, one way that we're able to see we can see things very big. We can see down the corridors of time. We can imagine ourselves, see the whole planet in our mind's eye. And so in some ways we're really small, but one way we're able to see ourselves as bigger and identify ourselves with something greater is with our communities. And the most immediate community is our nuclear family, and then by extension out, the extended family, then to the state and nation and so on. So I think, like, so for example, if a nation finds itself, you know, losing in a war or experiencing some sort of devastation or problem, that can be very devastating to you, because in a way it's an extension of yourself, even if you personally are prospering. So that's kind of how I'm saying that the children, I think it's worth reflecting on that they're it's a way of extending ourselves into the future. And so while we see them, of course, as different than us, it's also our continuing life. It's our meaning, our purpose that spreads across that broader expanse that we can see with our minds and hearts, but know in reality that we're not going to be there. And so it's like, in a way, it's kind of a death of ourselves, not just from a standpoint of identity, but in terms of, though I agree with that point, I'm just trying to continue to flesh that out. Yeah. Meaning, identity, purpose. And that's why, so let me just fast forward here. This is the thing that struck me the most about studying the book of Ruth at this time, is that I've heard many people talk about Ruth, and I've heard many people talk about Boaz, and I've heard many people discuss how great a companion Ruth is and how great it is that Boaz redeems them, which is all true. But I haven't heard the emphasis on what where the book actually ends up, which is actually with the birth of Obed and then eventually David. Like it might say, well, he's a descendant of Christ, you know, or Christ is his descendant. But it's the birth of the child that is the kind of the ultimate healer there. That's the where the real redemption takes place. He is the restorer of your life, is what the women say to him. So it's like she's bereft of that identity and of that hope. And now that hope is coming back because she has Obed, who is the son of Boaz and Ruth, but then is given to Naomi as the actual redeemer. And so, as I reflect on that, I think it's true that we have this strong sense that children are a connector to something greater and deeply rooted in our identity and deeply meaningful to us, which is why they are mourned so much. But I don't know if we always know how to celebrate that in the positive sense, that we can actually see that this is a huge good that we can rejoice in. I mean, to some degree we do that. But as I recounted in the post I did, I remember discussing with a person who had visited another culture, and he had a son there. And then the people responded to him with just like this, "You are a father. That is the greatest thing." And just congratulating him and honoring him. "You have a son." And it's like, I don't see that in our culture in the same way. Just that exuberance and exhilaration that they feel that you have a son that is clearly there in the book of Ruth. Like, this is the point. You have a son. And that son is the Redeemer. Anyway, so went on that for a long time, but part of it is because this has really captivated my imagination. Does that evoke any thoughts in you? No? As a mother of three sons, three wonderful sons, I might say.
I liked it. No, it's not wrong. It's not just the birth of a child, but the birth of a son that is specifically interesting to me, because I have found, and this may not be everyone's experience, but I have found that I almost am pitied when people find out I have three boys, or pitied because we don't have a daughter, or of some sort. And it's interesting to me that we don't rejoice over the birth of the son in the way that you're talking about. But to the same fact, I the Obed thing, I don't think I have heard anybody talk about that. That was actually the culmination of the book of Ruth. Maybe they should have called it the book of Obed.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it.
But do you really think that our culture doesn't celebrate the birth of sons? And maybe not in the same way that they did in the book of Ruth and the way that Wes was just talking about in other cultures. But I disagree
I think
we don't. It's not that we don't like say, "Oh, it's great that you have a son." But just the sheer, you know, it's like everybody's happy that a baby's born, you know, but just the sheer exhilaration that here is a son, specifically as son, not as baby, that is being celebrated there, I think is very interesting. And I have not experienced that. I mean, obviously it's somewhat anecdotal because, you know, we're going by our own experiences, but that is not a theme that I've seen.
And I think part part of it has to do with women specifically, because women value the relationship that they can have with their daughter, and they mourn the eventual loss of their son to another woman, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. You know, you have a son, and you and I have said this, I am raising my son straight and good. I want them to cleave to their wife and not continue to be a mama's boy in any sense of the word. But that will mean loss for me. And so I think that, coupled with the fact that our culture, this is maybe a bit controversial, but our culture has devalued men and even boyhood more so than manhood. Our culture is not set up for active risk-taking boys. That's been my experience as a mom of three boys. People have a heart attack sometimes whenever they, you know, see how active my boys are, or how you know, risk-taking they are. And I have really had to come to a place where I realize that my job as a boy mom is to take that risk-taking nature that is in a boy and just help cultivate the character in him, so that that thing that God has placed in those men will be used for his good and his glory. You know, men are the ones, we get upset about boys who play in mud, but that might be someday a boy, you know, or a boy who is like just crazy and rambunctious, but that will be the boy that someday will be running into a fire to save, you know, to save a kid who might be in there. Or just men are willing to do things because of that risk-taking nature that God has placed in them. Our job is to build that character that will go along with it. So
very, very good. Hey, Art, so you kind of heard us talk. I'd love to hear your further response.
Well, you know, everything you said, I totally agree with. I don't disagree with anything, but I still do somewhat disagree with. I think anybody listening to this and the three of us would understand the significance of a son that's placed in this book. So I have three daughters. So if I just dared say on this podcast, I was disappointed or wish I had a son, then someone would say, oh, you don't love your daughters. Or there would be this fear. They're going to be like, oh, now my daughters think I was disappointed in one of them, which just absolutely is not true whatsoever. Wes, you have six daughters, right?
Right.
And one son, but there's no way that you were disappointed in any of those. My oldest daughter.
It's not true, actually, but.
has one daughter and pregnant with another. And they're you know, thrilled to be having, you know, a daughter and hope to have a healthy baby. But at the same time, I think they're in the back of everyone's mind. There's just something special about a son. And I think it is the carrying on, just like you were talking about, of the legacy and the name and the future. That's just kind of different than it is with a girl.
Yeah. So no, I was actually disappointed. And it was something I had to struggle with, kind of in reverse of what Lacey was talking about. So Melinda's second pregnancy and fifth pregnancy were very similar. And the second pregnancy was a son, David. Mm-hmm. And so the fifth pregnancy, we just assumed it was exactly the same in a sense, no complications. And just a few minor things that she had experienced in the other pregnancies that she didn't experience with the fifth pregnancy. And then the baby came out, and it was a girl. That was a little rough because I was really thinking we were having a son. And I will just say this to kind of validate the point that Lacey is making about the relationship you have with your daughters. My aunt wrote me a little note when she found out that we had a daughter. And it says, "A boy is yours till he finds a wife. A daughter is yours for the rest of your life." And that actually really comforted me, just to think that that God had supplied me with these girls who would most likely give me attention and care throughout my life in a way that a son would not. Now, again, I think sons have great value, but it's different. So anyways, I think there's some understanding of the son, but I don't think going back to your point, I just don't think we embrace that as a culture. I don't think we embrace masculinity. Sometimes masculinity is just denied or downplayed. Masculinity is seen as toxic. And so not just that there's a potential for toxicity within masculinity, just as there is for femininity. And so that's kind of why I say we don't see the value of the son, again, as a baby. But your point is that those things are still there. I hear that. And that there are always things that we can, when you say them, when you capitalize them, when you go to the book of Ruth and see this, having it pointed out, you're like, yeah, you know, that does kind of make some sense. Because I think it's rooted in reality.
Right. And there's so much of the biblical story that is based on or important about the son and the relationship of the son, the relationship of the son with the father, going all the way back to the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. You know, the last plague was killing all the firstborn sons. This story talking about the sons and the significance of Obed being, you know, in the lineage of Jesus and Jesus being, you know, coming from David's throne and all that. And I don't know, sometimes I just see that what happens in our society with devaluing, and I know we don't want to get into that type of conversation probably, but I just see that as Satan trying to devalue the son and the relationship of the son and the family and the son to the father in order to somewhat devalue the gospel itself.
Sure. Because in some ways the Bible's all about the birth of a son.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
way to bring it around.
Thank you. Yeah, that is, but it's the big theme, right?
Right.
It is
like there's the son who's going to come and redeem the world.
Right.
And in a way, and you have a picture of that with Obed.
So I have a question about lineage. In Matthew 1, when it describes Obed, it describes him as Boaz. You know, Boaz had Obed. He remained their son. How did that work? How does that work?
I'm not sure I can answer that, but he is in fact their son, but he also becomes the son of Elimelech and Naomi. And so, but that continues through Boaz's line. He's also their son-in-law. So I know it's an interesting,
Maybe what happens with Ruth's first husband? He's kind of left Malon? Out of that. Yeah.
Oh, because he doesn't have an heir. Because he's a dead end in the genealogy.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, there's lots of stuff about that whole genealogy thing that I guess it's hard to answer the whys and the wherefores or whatever.
One interesting thing about that genealogy in Matthew 1, you know, two of the women, well, let's see, is Ruth in there?
No,
Ruth is not in there.
I think is very interesting.
But Tamar is, and you notice that Tamar is mentioned in Ruth chapter 4. So I just thought that's, you know, you get this genealogy and there's Tamar. So I think that in the thinking of the Jewish people, there was something that captivated their imagination in the specific women that were mentioned in the line of David and later of Christ, and of the as the line of David developed and went through there. So that when Matthew brings that in, and then I think it's Bathsheba or the Uriah's wife, maybe is how it's said, that those things are, you know, because they're not every wife is mentioned or not every mother is mentioned, the ones that are really stand out, and they were people that they thought about a lot and shaped their imagination and that they carried through. So like in the case of Rachel and Leah, they say to Ruth, may you be like Rachel and Leah who built up the house of Israel, because so that shaped not just, it wasn't just something that happened, but it was something that history was going to carry forward into the present and shape the way they looked at what was occurring there. So
in the couple minutes we have left, what does this matter to someone who's living a bitter life? So we talked about redemption for a bitter life. What does all this matter on the practical side? What's the takeaway?
Go ahead, Lacey.
My takeaway is that no matter how dark or bitter your life seems, there is hope, and it's found in a son. And the neat thing for every year, because it is a constant reminder of the fact that we have hope, and that it came to earth, that God came to earth as a baby and a son, and that ultimately he died on the cross. And so our bitter life is redeemed.
I think that's definitely the big takeaway. And as people, I mean, you're talking about Christmas there. That's what I was kind of thinking as you see the end of Ruth, that you see the joy and the hope of Christmas. And so what I would say is that as we experience those bitter struggles with life and difficulties, that we see the joy of Christmas. And it's like that anticipation that God is going to do something. God is going to send a son. He's going to redeem us. And that is, so we should, yes, we need to be honest about our struggles. We need to grieve our struggles. We need to grieve losses. But we don't do it as those who have no hope.
Amen.
It's kind of a good phrase from the Apostle Paul there.
Definitely. Any final thoughts from either one of you?
I think that's a good final thought. Mm-hmm. Anticipate the birth of the Son.
I agree. Definitely awesome. Thanks for talking today and being on here. Both of y'all, I appreciate you.
And appreciate you, Art.
Yeah, thanks.
And to those who are listening, thanks for listening. And we will catch you next time. God bless you.